This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 41 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. And joining me in the studio today is the well-travelled editor-in-chief of Aerospace magazine, Tim Robinson. Tim, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Peter. Hello, everybody.
Good to have you back. Gareth's not with us today. Gareth will join us for the next episode. But today we feature performance and success with a great interview with the RAF's most senior flight instructor, squadron leader Tim Davies. We also have what it takes to get a meteoric career like that of the UK's advanced aerobatic champion. That is, of course, Michael Picken. We got to talk to Mike during a break in his flying schedule. He was actually flying the Boeing Stearman at the time, and talking of Boeing, we've also got a fantastic interview with Dr. Rachel Ornan from Boeing, the Regional Director for Cabins Experience and Design. But it's probably been the busiest time we've had since the last episode on social media. And of course, we've been nominated in the top 10 aviation podcasts by Global Pilot Life. So a big thank you to Luke Haig, the media director at Pilot Life Group. And you can find them at globalpilotlife.com. Pretty good stuff that, Tim, hey?
It's not bad at all, no.
Yeah, only been doing it for a few years, and it's great to have some recognition. And the plaudits keep coming, and although we missed out for the show on a nomination for the International Aerospace Media Awards, Tim, you've been nominated in the category for Best Safety Training and Simulation Submission for your Aces High article in Aerospace magazine. So congratulations, and fingers crossed for the awards night in Paris, I think it is.
Yeah, thanks very much, Peter. Yeah, I'm up for that and another award on was it Best Defense article on the article I did about the US Boneyard. So
wow, okay, gosh,
the competition there is very, very stiff. So
it is. I've seen some of these,
and yeah.
But as I said, we've been absolutely overwhelmed by the response to the last two episodes. Now, I thought the Tomcat episode might prove to be our pinnacle in terms of feedback and engagement. But the last episode with Tony Blackman and Dave Gledhill simply took everyone by storm. Dave's book, of course, well, several of his books, but particularly his F4 Phantom book. We had a tweet we sent out with one of his pictures of an F4 Phantom climbing away. That tweet got 250,000 views on Twitter.
Wow.
Tons and tons of likes, and I think 70, 80 retweets just for that one F4 photo. So an absolutely amazing amount of feedback and engagement from everyone. We're absolutely flabbergasted. So thank you very much for that. Okay, moving on. Just a quick mention for the inserts for today's programme. They come courtesy of The Aviationist, of course, the famous blog produced by David Cenciotti. It's the sharing of communications between a US P-8 Poseidon and the People's Liberation Navy of China over the disputed waters in the South China Sea. We've edited out some of the downtime and the other aircraft. It was recorded on the guard frequency, but we hope you enjoy listening to that in between our segments. And talking of busy, Tim, you really have been busy. You've been away.
Yeah, I've been on a sort of a obviously one of these pre-Paris media trip, or trips as I should say, with Boeing in the US. So that involved a mix of commercial, looking at what's happening in Seattle, and also in the defense business as well. So very, very interesting stuff. Got to visit a lot of places, from Seattle to San Antonio to the Chinook line, V-22 line in Philadelphia. And also a satellite factory in El Segundo, California, which is literally about 5 minutes from LAX Airport, Los Angeles Wow. International Airport. And you know, you kind of hear inside the sort of nondescript sort of industrial buildings are these giant satellites, vacuum chambers and what have you. It's pretty amazing. And it's also like a quite historic for those with a keen eye on aviation history. And it was one of Howard Hughes's sort of businesses there.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Now, you also got to visit a couple of museums. I did saw some of your social media coverage there, Tim. But you also got to meet one of the show's great supporters, Isaac Alexander.
That's right. Shout out there to Jet City Star. If you know him on Twitter, you'll know he's a one-man news organization and Twitter fiend. So, yeah, great to catch up with him there. As I say, it wasn't all work. Did get out into Payne Field in Seattle and saw an IL-2 Sturmovik fly with Paul Allen's collection of historic aircraft. That was pretty cool. And also, at that aviation day, there was a couple of helicopters from the 160th. Special Operations Aviation Regiment, or the Night Stalkers. So that was pretty cool as well.
Yeah. There, you've got some good photos on your Twitter feed. So anyone interested in catching up on some of that traffic, go over and follow Tim and you'll see some pretty impressive photos. Okay, Tim, we got a lot to get through. So let's see what's caught our eye in the news recently. Okay, first story comes from PR.com and it's a press release announcing that the RAF's six TriStars are going to be brought back into use. The AGD systems, they are going to get hold of them and use them for commercial operations, but in effect leasing them back to the military. That was an interesting take. I didn't quite expect that to happen, Tim.
No, I mean it's kind of interesting that they've come back into sort of service. Obviously, good for TriStar enthusiasts. It's not a weird idea as it seems. I mean, Omega Air. You saw the famous photos from last month or the month before of the X-47B doing aerial refueling. That was actually refueling from an Omega Air 707.
Yeah.
These enablers like ISR and tankers, that they are key enablers for today's armed forces. And armed forces are always short of, extra tankers in the sky. So having an extra capability that you could, book and obviously pay for, that's got to be good, especially when there's so many different, trouble spots flaring up around the world where you might need them. We're looking at places, obviously over Iraq, you've got things going on over Yemen, you've got trouble in the South China Sea. So, extra tankers, probably a good business to be in.
Yeah, and anyone who follows me on Twitter will know that my avatar actually at this moment in time is one of those Amiga DC-10s at Farnborough a year or two ago. Anyway, moving on, I do know someone, by the way, over in East Anglia who's a big TriStar fan, so if they're listening, you know who you are. I'm sure you'll take a great deal of enjoyment from that. Sadly, though, Tim, since we last recorded, another incident, this time for the A400M. We lost an airframe, and sadly, four of the six crew were lost as well. On its first test flight, an aircraft bound for the Turkish Air Force. But I believe there's some talk on social media at the moment about a potential glitch in the fuel system.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously it's difficult to know until the full report comes out for that. And, you know, thoughts are with the sort of families and the kind of close-knit, you know, flight test community. You know, I've been down there, visit them regularly. Kind of shocking, you know, for this, you know, in a time really where, you know, you don't have, you don't tend to have these accidents in flight tests that you used to, you know, you were just so regular in the sort of 50s or 60s, you know. So something obviously got badly wrong. It was unrecoverable by the look of it. And I think we've just got to wait and see what the accident investigators will say. You know, wider, you know, Airbus was talking end of this year of trying to speed up their deliveries. You know, people were wanting to get their A400Ms quicker, the C-130Js, whatever people have leftovers that people have got. They're running out of running out of hours, and people are looking forward and saying, you know, to this next generation airlifter. So obviously that is going to be slowed down, you know, significantly. You know, nothing you can do about that, but it is going to put more pressure on these air forces and these sort of aging airframes to keep them going a little bit longer.
Yeah, sadly, we were tweeting, as we often do, a group of aircraft on a particular day, and bizarrely, and it was complete coincidence, that was the day we chose to tweet the grisly photos. So thank you to everyone who immediately informed us when the incident became apparent. I was out and about at the time, so got a tweet, and we managed to pull those. Saying that, it's a great aircraft. Love those photos from Airbus. So we will rerun those in the future. Let's move off to space. We haven't covered too many space topics recently. The Russians are in trouble, Tim. They've lost now a Progress rocket as well as a Proton. There's also Sarah Brightman has pulled out of her little trip to the ISS. I don't know if they're related or not, but they really have had a torrid time in the last month or two, haven't they?
Yeah, well, first off, there was the Progress unmanned. You know, fortunately, all these are unmanned, but the Progress unmanned so resupply ship, that went out of control, started spinning around out of control. And then sort of re-entered. You know, fortunately, it was nowhere near the ISS, but you know that was a loss. And then we've had the Proton rocket, which blew up. If there is any positive side, that there does seem to be accelerating alternatives to getting to the ISS.
Yeah,
with things like SpaceX, Boeing, etc.
Yeah, CS-100.
Exactly. So there are other options are kind of moving forward now, kind of and accelerating, making progress.
Yeah, and I did swap tweets, actually messages with Gene McCulker, a good friend of the show, who is obviously an expert in this field, about these issues. And one of the things he feels is that potentially it's a blow to the commercial space operations in Russia, particularly with SpaceX being so competitive moving forward. And of course, with Europe developing the Ariane 6, I heard the Director General of ESA on the Aero Society's podcast only this very week talking about that. So the competition's really hotting up. So challenging times for the Russians. We wish them the very best in correcting those issues, because, of course, there are astronauts on the ISS that do need those vehicles to help them get back.
And it's interesting also that these things sort of go in cycles. You know, the briefing with Boeing's defense sort of satellite business in California. You know, they pointed out that at the moment there is a an excess of satellites and not enough launches to send them up.
Yeah.
Whereas previously, I think, you know, sort of maybe 10, 20 years ago, it was the way around. You know? So, you know, at the moment, there's a whole lot of people who want to get their satellites into space quickly. And you wonder whether they, you know, as you go forward, you know, everyone will kind of bring their launches into service, and suddenly there'll be overcapacity.
Yeah, yeah, true. But as Gene gently reminded me, the overcapacity should hopefully bring the costs down.
Exactly.
And yeah, in the long term, that's going to be to the benefit of all of us. Tim, just before we go off of the news then into our first segment, don't know if you had the chance to see this. John Copeland sent us a link to the Fokker and GKN article about supplying the first quote-unquote Skyview window. Apparently for a converted BBJ. This is a nice rectangle rounded corner window, nice and big, quite interesting, but I'd like to see it on an aircraft, I think.
Well, I mean, that's a, was it a 1.5 meter long window? Yes. Whoa, I mean, that is
what a view.
Fantastic. I mean, that is you know, I mean, GKN Aerospace, what a great company. You know, really good in kind of transparencies, canopies. That's just one of their skills, as well as structures. You know, they do the British company that does the F-22 canopy.
Yep.
So this is something interesting for BizJet users. Obviously, that'll be the first application. You know, if you're buying a BBJ, you know, 737 BBJ.
Yeah.
You know, why not fit these windows? But you know, maybe one day we'll see it on you know, commercial aircraft.
And as we'll hear from Rachel a little later, there's some very interesting innovations coming along from manufacturers like Boeing. So stay tuned. We'll leave the news there. We'll take a quick break, and after the break, we'll come back to hear from Tim Davies.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
For a military airplane, you are approaching my military security ear. Please go away quickly in order to run government. Is it me?
This is calling U.S. military aircraft. Please identify yourself. I am a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace. I am operating with due regard as required under international law.
This is the Chinese Navy. This is the Chinese Navy. This is the Chinese Sky. A foreign military airplane, you are approaching my military secret ear. Please go away quickly in order to run government.
Station calling U.S. military aircraft. Please identify yourself.
Okay, in order to run government. Read me.
Station calling U.S. military aircraft. Please identify yourself.
This is the Chinese Navy. This is the Chinese Navy. This is the Chinese Terror Sky. Please go away quickly in order to run judgment.
I am a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace. I am operating with due regard as required under international law.
Hi, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's own aviation podcast. I like to listen to Extended.
Now, we got to talk to the RAF's most senior flight instructor, that's squadron leader Tim Davies. Now, Tim produces a podcast, actually, and also a blog all about success and performance. There is a little bit of aircraft and aviation involved in it, but it's predominantly about the psychology of success, because his job is about training the fast jet pilots for the RAF. So the cream of the cream. And he's using this program to talk about success, not only in flight, but in other areas as too. So we got to ask Tim what this was all about.
So
Tim, welcome to Extended.
Yeah, thanks so much, Peter. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, thanks very much for taking the time out of your very, very busy schedule. First, I'd just like to say that the views that are expressed today are all of your own and not of your employers. And I'd like to say that just on your behalf, because I think it's important we just make that clear before we start. But let's get on with hearing a little bit more about FastJet performance. We've got a lot of listeners around the world who are in the industry, but we've got a lot who want to join it. I was fascinated to hear your first couple of episodes of the program. What's it about and why did you decide to produce it?
Yeah, well, thanks so much, Peter. You see, you know, I am passionate about personal development. And I always have been. So personally, I was never that motivated by formalized educational methods as I was growing up. And I had to find my own way to learn. So I failed at every stage of my education, pretty much, whether that be school, university, whether it's in flying training. And now I'm the most senior FastJet flying instructor in the Royal Air Force. So I had to create processes as I went through in order to achieve that. What FastJet Performance is about is taking whatever it is that you're doing now to that next level. So it's looking at how do you improve your life? What small areas do you need to concentrate on to achieve the big results? It's, if you will, it's putting together all of the small changes that are going to result in the big shift in performance. So how do you go from the top 10% to the top 1% of people? And actually, it's not a big jump. It's a very small jump. Really, what we're trying to get at here is, you know, how do you do it better? How do you get more enjoyment from it? How can you appreciate what you're doing more? And how can you use what you're learning to contribute more to those around you? I think this is really it. You know, what is it that makes champions? What creates success? And what makes a better you, really? I would like to say, though, that FastJet Performance isn't a recruitment poster for the RAF. It's a recruitment poster for personal self-development and being the best that you can be. So it was something that I never had when I was looking for help, when I was trying to work out my future, or when I was trying to get to the next level in my working environment. The way I look at it, it's like, how do you get from the line worker to the executive level? How do you become that chief salesman? Or if you're a race driver, and I speak to race drivers, you know, and I say to them, right, let's try and get your lap times down, because actually there's a process we can put in place that we can try and do that. I think that's really it. It's about self-improvement. You know, we all deserve that. We all deserve to give ourselves that. It's, you know, let's improve ourselves so that everyone else can benefit, whether your friends, your family, whether you can be a better parent, mother, husband. And the way I look at it sometimes, without getting too much out there, but, you know, are we after financial or spiritual wealth? Most people don't actually know what they want, Peter, to be honest with you. So I think that the strength of the site is in making people think.
Well, it certainly did that for me, Tim. And I was slightly intrigued as to what you would say when I first came across the program more than the website. But one of the things that I took from it, I took a few nuggets and I thought, do you know what? I can really apply that to my own life. I'd love to be a FastJet pilot, but those days are sadly behind me. Particularly the episode on management over leadership, I found quite intriguing. How you differentiated between the two and the fact that you used, I suppose, some academia based thinking, but then overlaid your own thoughts and experience on top of it. And I took a great deal from that and took some lessons out to actually use for myself. It was really great advice. And I think what I found from FastJet Performance is it's quick, it's snappy. You even tell people to run it at a slightly faster speed. You know, don't waste your time. Take the nuggets. Let's get on with it.
You know what? Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's what I try and do. The thing is, I can walk to work. It takes 40 minutes. So I listen to books on Audible. I download Blinkist, which is another great app you can use, which gives you the salient points of a book in about 15 minutes. So there are ways. When someone writes a book, Pete, this is the thing. They're going to write a book about maybe 3 or 4 points, and they've got to pad it out. See, we used to think that we had to finish books. That's what we're taught in school. You must finish books. But you don't have to finish books. You can leave the last third if they're padding it out and if you can recognize that. You've got to take out that there's so much information out there, you can't possibly expect to read it all. So I'm just trying to say to people, you know, you take what bits you need. And that's why I say to people, download a podcast if you can. I play podcasts at 1.5 times, and you get that information a lot quicker than if you were to sit there trawling through a whole world of material that can largely be irrelevant. That's the problem.
Yeah. Now you are a military career pilot. So just coming back to fly in an aerospace, and you've worked with some extremely senior officers. I had a little dig around to find out a bit about you, and right. You've flown some of the UK's fast jets. What attributes would you say made the difference to making your career a success?
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. I thinking about this, I think really we have to define what success is, because it's different for different people. For example, just very briefly, my father was a police officer for 37 years, but he never rose above the rank of PC. He chose down promotion at every opportunity, but he drove traffic cars, and he was one of the oldest armed response units officers in Portsmouth. Up until a few years before he died, in fact, he had a great job, he loved the work, and he worked with great people. The thing is, he knew very senior officers that were very successful, obviously, if we define that as success. But they'd been through three divorces. They'd moved jobs every 3 years within the force. They looked very successful, but obviously they weren't very happy. So, you know, what is success to one man isn't the same to another. Now, I've got guys I know on the Typhoon who want to do everything they can to hold on to a cockpit. And I know others that would get out of that cockpit in a second for the rank and the prestige. You know, isn't it strange?
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
In answer to your question there, my career was all based on contribution, and my brother was the same. He flies for the Royal Canadian Air Force at the moment on Hercules over there. So I've always felt that I wanted to put in to the military, and I've always felt that you need to contribute to operational theatres, because you have to remain relevant as well within the service. We're always taught when we go on operations to leave the operation better than when you found it. You know, that's the thing. So, and that's actually a pretty good thing for doing at work, isn't it, really? You know, leave your workplace better than as you found it. You can't try and develop or try and grow that environment you're in. For me, as I said, drive and determination was exceptionally important, because I was stumbling all over the place as I came through my flying training. But I also believe sacrifice and humility is also very important when you're coming in through the ranks, because you're going to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. If you put yourself in that stretch zone, as my students do and my instructors do, then you're going to make errors. But these aren't malicious errors, Pete. You know, these are errors you're making. You're stretching your boundaries. So.
Tim, you've a couple of times since we've started talking, you've talked about tripping up, some errors that you've made, and you talked earlier about struggling in your education. Tell us a little bit about how this has all sort of come together for you to be one of the most senior instructors in the RAF, if not in the MOD. How do you feel that those lessons have benefited you? Because it's very rare for people to have that humility to admit those sort of errors along the way.
Well, I tend to find the guys that don't admit that aren't here anymore. I think it's quite interesting, when you say that. I mean, that's probably what pushed me to start the site, really. I deal with a lot of young men and women that contact me through Twitter or the site direct and ask me questions, trying to work out whether a service career is for them or how to get ahead in their particular business. Of course, these are young people. They're there where I was, 20 years ago now, I suppose. And I think it's quite important to be open. In fact, I don't know why we'd ever hide this. I mean, we all make mistakes along the line, and I've made mistakes as I came through. And what I've done is learn from those mistakes and pick myself up. And that's probably got me to the position I am right now. Now, the Air Force is an environment that allows you to make mistakes, picks you up. We all learn together, and then we all move on. We're quite lucky in that respect. It's not going to throw you out the door. And in fact, it will grow as an organization as we develop these things, and we can pass those mistakes on to the students and the instructors, of course, we train. But my background, I mean, it all started really education-wise with A-levels when I was very busy within the Air Training Corps. I was doing a lot of flying with Air Training Corps. I was at the stage where I believe I was a sergeant there, and I was very much invested in running of the squadron. And I obviously didn't put enough time into my education. So I went to university and did an HND instead of going straight to a degree. In fact, I applied to the Air Force first. I got a flying scholarship with them. And then I pretty much moved from that to applying again for entry. And they said no good university, which is quite common to do, actually. And so I went to university. And from there, I played in the Army for a bit, joined the Navy, and ended up in the Air Force. It's all a bit of a...
So where did the passion for flight come from, Tim?
Right, okay. So when I was very young, now, this is probably one of my first memories. I must have been, and this sounds... I mean, how do you remember back then? I must have been about 4 or 5. And I was with my father in northern France, and we'd just come back from holiday, and we're in I think it must have been a petrol station. I can't really remember what it was, but he said I could have a toy. And the two toys that he had out was, one was a plastic kind of tool set, you know, with little screwdrivers and things like that. And then the other one was a a cardboard cutout of an airfield where you built the airfield and you built the little cardboard planes. And of course, yeah. I think he wanted me to pick the little tool set, but I picked the little airport instead. Now, and I think that's probably where it started at a very young age. And with pilots, it generally does. I'm sure you look up and you think that's interesting and I want to do that. And I was no different. I think the first time I flew, and I've gone through my, I found it for you. I found this for you. It's called a 3822. It's the Air Cadets RF Form 3822. It's Air Cadets Record of Service. So I was going through this, and this is going back a bit now. And
what's the date on it, yeah, Tim, exactly. If you don't mind me asking?
I knew you'd ask. Right, let's have a look. So I've got it here. So what am I doing? This is 88 when I first joined with my parent or guardian's consent to entry. That's brilliant, isn't it? So I've got that in there with my little signature saying I promise to do things, which is going back. And the first time I flew, flicking through this here, right at the back, I believe it was in a glider, in a Vigilant glider. Well, I've got Chipmunk here back in 88, August 88. And these are all 30-minute flights in Chipmunks.
Yeah.
And then, here we go. This is a bit of the back, isn't it? I didn't notice this. And then, yes, right. So I've got a glider flying log in the back here. And that's 89. That's January 89. This was at Upavon. Okay. It was so cold.
Wow.
Having to push these gliders out.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I don't know why people do it. It should be a warm weather sport only. And in here, I've got flights for 1 minute. And that must have been a cable break, I guess. And 5 minutes and 6 minutes. And so that was when I first started flying. But even before that, when I must have been 12 or 13, there was a local airfield in Chichester. And it must have been about 30 miles from the house, 20 miles from the house. And yeah. I cycled out there and I said to a flying school there, if I clean your aircraft, I think they had two aircraft. If I clean your aircraft every weekend, can you give me a flight sometime? Is that all right? And the guy was very good and he said yes. So, you know, I cycled up there with buckets on the handlebars and I would clean the aircraft for weekends on end. And then every month they'd take me up for 30 minutes. And that's really how I really got into flying. And I was pretty hooked from there, to be honest with you.
Now, you've flown some of, as I mentioned earlier, the RAF's fast jets. You've flown all sorts of things. And I think maybe for another day we can talk about some of those aircraft. But one that I picked out was the Tornado GR4. You flew that. You've been active in terms of your flight experience there. I'm not going to go into too much about that. But how do you satisfy your current role? How does that satisfy your flying desires, you know, that passion for flight?
Yeah, that's very interesting, actually. It's interesting what you say about the Tornado, because Tornado pilots are very, very fond of the aircraft. And if we're honest, you know, we actually do very much enjoy flying with a navigator and a weapon systems officer, because it's a very team environment. I'm a big fan of the platform, I really am. And it would be a real shame when we lose that. Now, interesting what you say, because when a guy comes back from the front line, I was no different, and you put him in flying training, a lot of the time, of course, we're not flying that airplane ourselves. The student is flying it. So you have to transition away from the actual handling of the aircraft yourself into the delivery of that education that you're doing. And I think when you see the student grow, when he goes off first solo, it's like anything, whether you're teaching in elementary flying training or basic fast jet training or attack weapons, as I teach in now, When that guy comes back and he's brought the aircraft back and he's brought himself back in one piece, which is always a bonus, you do get a lot from that, because you realize that what you have delivered has been taken on board. So it's really, that's pretty much what we get from flying training and getting a guy onto the front line. I've got, I've been teaching about 15 courses now that have come through, probably a bit less than that, to be honest with you. And seeing the guys now, I've got operational guys on the GL4 and we've got guys on the Typhoon as well. In fact, the first girl we put through on four squadron is now operational, fully operational on the Typhoon. So
Wow. That
sort of thing is good. They phone you up and we chat to them. It's great. They're going to come back to the school in 3 or 4 years probably. So yeah. it's a very...
And are they coming back as instructors themselves?
Yeah. Or? Now, what we tend to do, they tend to be quite invested on the Typhoon. The training that they get obviously is quite comprehensive. So they might do a longer tour before coming back. But you're right, they will then probably come back into our flight school as instructors. That's right.
Right. Okay. Interesting stuff. So you're training the fast jet pilots for aircraft like the Typhoon. Being a little bit more technical, I suppose, what's the difference between the pilots and the training that they go through for these much more highly computerized aircraft like the Typhoon compared to what some describe as the steam gauge aircraft that are still in the portfolio but are moving out? Is it a different skill set in terms of the instructors that you need to deliver that sort of training?
Well, I have instructors now that are ex-Tornado pilots and ex-Typhoon pilots as well. And, you know, I went through on 19 squadron on the Hawk T1, and I was a T1 instructor on 208 squadron for about 3 years before I was on 4 squadron on the T2.
Right.
So we're still putting guys from the T1 onto the Typhoon. the training that we deliver on the T2, the aircraft replicates the Typhoon cockpit in quite a lot of detail. So it has three multifunction displays. We can go through menu systems. All the checks we do when we're talking about weapons checks are the same as the Typhoon as well. So we go through the same process. We're building in processes. So insofar as how is the student different when they go on to?
Yeah, I suppose the skills you need to train a pilot who's using, I suppose, a different type of platform. A lot of people talk about nowadays about the use of glass cockpits and the iPad generation is a very different way of learning. And interestingly, Tim Robinson was telling us recently about something Airbus have come to the conclusion on how people learn. And that is that, like the iPad, when you pick an iPad or a tablet up, most young children can use it intuitively very quickly, and they do it by practicing.
Yeah.
They don't do it by process.
Yeah.
And Airbus are starting to learn that it's better to teach pilots to fly their aircraft by allowing them to, shall we say, fail and go through the process and see what works and what doesn't work on a simulator type platform, rather than sit in a cockpit, learn process and procedure, learn the drills, and then try and learn that way. And I suppose the question that I had is training a Typhoon pilot a bit like that? Is it more intuitive in terms of the way that the aircraft flies, and therefore you need to train them, or is it more process driven like the old steam gauge Tornadoes?
Well, for a second there, I thought we were going to go down the whole Airbus versus Boeing debate.
No, that was going to be God. We've done programs on that.
We haven't got time, not in my life, to get out there. Well, that's a really interesting question you asked, that because exactly that. What we first did with the T2 is we said, and in fact, we've got a pilot on our squadron who's done an exchange tour with the Australian F-18. In fact. And on the F-18 out in Oz, they will say for an air-to-ground mission, we're going to set the screens up in a certain way. For an air-to-air mission, we're going to set the screens up in a different way. Now, that's how we started going down the route on the T2. We said, if you're going to be doing the air-to-ground, I want this on this side, that on that side, and this in the middle. Now, I was running the instructor training at the time, and we came up with we all sit down. We go through a lot of discussions about the students when they finish or halfway through the course, or we always have review periods. And we came to the conclusion, and it's brilliant that you brought this up, actually. This is so relevant, that what if we let the student work it out for themselves? And a classic example of this is, as they're going into a simulated attack profile, we loft paveway 4 is not real bombs. It's all synthetic. It's all simulated. Yeah. They have to go through a stores page, and they have to select the weapon and check that the correct parameters have been programmed in the weapon on the ground. It's something they need to do when they're crewing the aircraft. They make sure that they've selected the right weapon system for the attack. Now, when they're airborne and they go through the IP, they need to look at that weapon system. They need to check parts of it and make sure all the data is in. Now, the interesting thing about this is, because we can have an electronic warfare range anywhere in the country, because we can program it into the airplane, or we can do it before we actually get in the airplane, we normally drop surface wear missile systems very close to the target. So as they pull up, they normally pull up into these missile systems, they'll be illuminated and they'll be targeted and fired upon synthetically, of course. Now, if they've gone back, they left their stores page up, they cannot see the radar warning receiver because it's not displayed where it should be. So they have to go back to select the radar warning receiver. So we don't tell them to do this, but you know what? The first time they're shot down, they never do it again. They will always select the RWR again. So because in the head-up display, we have an aircraft kill pop up, you see. So that's the thing. So we let them now set the jet up however they want. More on B flight, on A flight, on the advanced flying training, yes, we do have to say, look, wouldn't it be beneficial to have your hydraulics up? Wouldn't it be beneficial to have your map here? On B flight, though, on the attack weapons, they're about to go to the front line. Okay, there's your airplane, set it up. But if you miss something, well, there's the learning experience there, isn't it? So that's how we do that, really, yeah.
Right, okay. Well, Tim, I'd love to carry on chatting, that intrigues me about your career, and we do want to focus a little bit on, you know, leadership success and some of those things that come through fast jet performance. You had a very unusual career change. You mentioned the Navy in one of your podcasts, and it intrigued me, and I went and had a look, and you went through Britannia Royal Naval College. How did you end up in the RAF?
Well, yeah, this is interesting. Wastes and strays is what it was. People looking for a job. what happens is, at the time, and it's still the way it is, we have naval officers, obviously, that train students with us at the moment. But as I came through, I was at Valley with about 7 other naval officers, and we got to the end of our training on 19, all to step to the Sea Harrier, the FA2. Yeah. And literally, I think I had, did I have 3 or 4 trips left? It wasn't very many at all when they announced the decision to decommission the aircraft, which of course was all we ever wanted to fly. That was where we wanted to go, and now we couldn't get onto the platform. And that was, this was, none of us were helicopter pilots. We were all, we'd all come through organically through the fast jet route. So the Navy said to us, listen, we've invested all this time in training. To put you back through rotary now is a pain for us. But the Air Force will take you on board if you want to transfer. Now, the thing about pilots when they're training is they're fiercely loyal to the service they've joined, as you can imagine. So the last thing we want to do was transfer service. But to be honest, the offer they made us was a very mature offer. And of course, we'd never look back. I transferred to a Northern Tornado Squadron. I went to 12 Squadron Lossiemouth. Which was a great squadron to be on, and they're very operationally focused squadron, which was great for me. Had guys behind that went to the F3, and some guys, in fact, were so far back but that by the time they finished Valley, they were able to go on to the Royal Air Force Harrier, and they eventually some transferred into the service and some stayed in the Navy. I elected to transfer to the Royal Air Force. My brother was joining the Royal Air Force at the time. But to be honest with you, with Britannia Royal Naval College, you know, that is fantastic training. It really is. I look back on my initial officer training very fondly. So leaving the Navy was a very difficult thing for me to do, yeah. But that's how that happened.
Right, okay. Well, Tim, just before we sign off, you've reached probably the echelons of instruction. As I said, you've flown some of the greatest aircraft we have in the portfolio. You've worked with extremely senior officers. What nugget can you give to some of our younger listeners who are thinking about a career, a military flying career?
You know, it's interesting, really, because these are the sort of things I try and cover on the website. A lot of people I speak to don't have the self-confidence to present themselves. And it's understandable. It's a very difficult world out there. Hmm. If you can, in fact, just a very brief story for you. My wife, she goes to Greece tomorrow. She's the vice president of a very prestigious organization within the UK. But even when she goes out there, she's still worried about how she is going to look in front of all these people that she's known for years. And I say to her, you know, there's some exercises you can do. It really is about trying to get some self-confidence, trying to recognize that it's going to be difficult. Of course it's difficult. If it wasn't difficult, my mother would be flying fast jets now. I mean, it's hard. And I could train anyone to fly a fast jet, but I can't do it in the number of hours that I've got to train you. So yeah. I think the biggest thing I could say is that you will fall down. You will be with other high achievers. You won't be the best person there. There will always be someone with you, better than you, as you go through. So expect to fail, but it's how you deal with yourself after that failure. You've got to pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and learn from that experience. And that's not an easy thing to do, Peter, learning from your own failure.
No.
But we do embrace failure on the squadron, very much so. And we use that as a learning example and take that forward. And we share that experience with other students. So as a course, it's very rare a guy will get through by himself.
Right.
It's very rare, in fact. But what we need is when a guy does fail a sortie, he shares it with his course mates. They learn from it. They don't make the same mistake again. You see what I mean?
Right. Yeah, understand.
And that's what I'd probably say is, you know, embrace failure is probably the best thing.
Well, there is a massive amount of advice and guidance for anyone thinking of starting out on a career in this sector, but also for those of us in the commercial world or in other walks of life. There's a great deal we can get from fast jet performance. Don't be mistaken by the title. It's not about flying fast jets. It's about how you handle your life, how you learn to succeed, and some of the attributes of those leaders. So, Tim, thank you very much for joining us. I really, really enjoyed it. Would love to have you back. We can maybe talk about aeroplanes a little bit more. But more importantly, where can we find out about you and FastJet Performance online?
Yeah, well, if you just type FastJet Tim Davies into Google, you tend to find a front page that's got a few things on it, I've noticed. So FastJetPerformance.com is the site itself, but I'm also on iTunes. So you can literally, as I said, just have that go straight to podcast. And in crikey, you know, by all means, speed me up is the best way. If you're a big Twitter follower, then @TimDavies_UK or @FastJetPerform, I'm there as well. And I'm putting out content the whole time, really. That's not necessarily on the site as well, just to keep guys informed about what's going on, what's going to come up. I've got a few projects that I'm going to put on there that are quite interesting. So I'm letting guys know about that. And those are probably the best ways, really, of getting a hold of me. So by all means, come and join the conversation. It's an interesting one to be had.
Tim, fascinating stuff. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Peter. I really appreciate it.
really interesting, Tim, getting to talk to Tim Davies there. Very likeable chap, fantastic speaker.
Yeah, I mean, what I think is fantastic is that you know, he kind of alludes to there about having this access. You know, the great thing about obviously sort of social media and internet and is able to have this access to, you know, people like Tim or other pilots, to be able to sort of, like, you know, give you this sort of insight or this first-hand experience, sort of experience and career tips and things like that, about when you are, if you are there as a young person, you're just thinking, well, what's the best one to do? What's the best path to take? You know, how do I get into flying? You know, not everyone has the time to do that. Not everyone wants to do that. But, you know, if I look back into my sort of dating myself here, but, you know, in the 80s with the air training corps, you know, you'd have the people on the squadron, but in terms of interaction with you know, a fast jet pilot like that, you know, you might be able to sort of say two words to them on an annual camp. Or perhaps you could go flying with them and in the back of a chipmunk. But it would be very limited. You know, so. Kudos to Tim for setting this up, and for, you know, it's useful for, you know, he's advising you know, racing car drivers, you know, how to get better lap times. So having that kind of focus and taking that kind of fighter pilot's mentality, you know, into rare areas, you know, other parts of your life, great stuff.
No, really impressed. I've taken a few of the tips from Tim myself into my career in terms of things like working on priorities and multitasking and things like that. So very, very useful. And we're hoping to see if Tim one day will come back and guest host with us. So looking forward to that. Okay, moving on now, I got the chance to speak to Mike Peckham. Mike is the youngest advanced aerobatic champion that the UK has ever had. And we got to talk to him about his career in between flying wing walkers in a Boeing Stearman. Today I'm with Michael Peckham, the 2014 UK Advanced Aerobatic Champion. Michael, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
We're at Compton Abbas today and you're working. But Mike, Advanced Aerobatic Champion, for those unfamiliar with the class, what does that sector cover and what does that mean?
So basically within the UK and also worldwide really, there are five different levels of aerobatics, so starting at beginners and then moving eventually all the way up to unlimited.
Yeah.
So advanced is basically the second top category.
Right, okay.
And in that level within the UK, you're able to represent the country abroad, basically in international aerobatic competitions. So.
Right, and you hide your light under a bushel because you're the youngest to hold that title ever, aren't you?
I am, yeah. So I won it last year when I was 23, so I'm not sure what the record was before, but probably in the 40s somewhere. Or
right, okay.
Something like that.
Okay, so tell us about the aircraft you fly. Can you tell us the capabilities and the performance of the aerobatic that you normally fly for aerobatics?
So the aerobatic aircraft I fly is called a CAP 232. It's a French-built. The original design is from the mid-90s, really, but it's a very capable aeroplane with just over 300 horsepower. So power to weight is very good because it's also very light. Built out of carbon fibre and also some parts of wood. And, yeah, really good performance. It rolls very quickly and you can almost use the engine as a gyroscope, you know, to do some crazy tumbles and things like that. So lots of different things you can do, and it's very competitive internationally.
Yeah. So how did this passion for aviation and flying start?
Well, my dad was a pilot when I was younger. Well, he still is. And he used to take me up when I was young, so that kind of sparked it all off, I guess. And I just got really involved in it. It was something that I was really interested in, and I just wanted to develop it. And aerobatics came along, and my dad was also involved in aerobatics. So, you know, people go down different routes. Some people like gliding, cross countries. But for me, it was always a really aerobatic. So.
Right, okay. And what competition are you involved in this year?
So this year I'm doing the British National Championships once again, but I'm moving up to the top level now, which is unlimited.
So you're not defending your class, you're moving up.
I'm going to move up, yeah. So I'll be at the top level this year. And there's probably about five pilots in the UK now that are competitive at the unlimited level. So
right.
It's going to be a stiff competition, but yeah. I look forward to the challenge.
And is it the same aircraft that you're flying in that category?
It's the same aircraft, yeah. The aircraft is capable up to the top level.
Right.
But obviously you can fly it at a lower level depending on your ability and yeah. how you feel comfortable. So
okay. And what differentiates the different classes? What are the sorts of challenges that you'll face in the new class that you didn't necessarily challenge so much in the existing class?
Well, it's mainly technical difficulty, really. And, you know, things progress and there are harder manoeuvres and kind of a wider envelope, if that makes sense. Yeah, so lots of different... The class is unlimited, so technically there isn't really a limit as to what you can get.
Right, OK.
Whereas
okay.
in some of the other lower levels, yeah. it's restricted to yeah. certain okay. criteria.
And what's how many rounds where are you going to be flying this year? What's involved in challenging for that title?
So the National Championships here will be held in Sywell, Northamptonshire,
yeah.
and that will be the first weekend in June.
Right, okay.
We fly four different aerobatic flights for the title of National Champion,
yeah.
and then there's a freestyle event at the end yeah. where we all kind of let our hair down, put a bit of smoke in, and you know, you get to kind of put out your personality in a flight and yeah. show okay. it to the crowds a bit more.
Okay. Now, that will be just around when this program comes out, so we'll be asking people to go along and support you if they hear this beforehand. But your day job is involved in the sector, but it's not in competition.
No, it's not. So they always say, don't they, if you can find something where you work and you enjoy it and it's your hobby, then you're doing well. So I fly Boeing 737s for a living for a UK travel company.
Yeah.
And I've been doing that for about 3 years now. So
right, OK.
It's different to flying aerobatics, and it's, you know, it's a different kind of discipline, really. But the thing I like about aviation is that, you know, from kind of grassroots up, there's always different things. And people say, oh, do you not get a bit bored flying straight and level? Well, no, because it's a different challenge. You know, you're yeah. flying heavy aircraft in different weather, flying passengers around, and it's satisfying in a different way, really. So
yeah, and you're really enjoying it. I can hear it in your voice, and I know that you've said many times that although there's a big difference between the types of flying, you enjoy flying the heavy commercials as well as the sporty small aircraft as well.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's just a different discipline, and it's nice to be able to do all kind of different forms of aviation. So for yeah. that, I think I'm quite lucky, really, to be able to do that.
Right, OK. Tell me a little bit, Michael, about your career steps then. You are quite young to hold the role that you do. Tell us what you've had to go through to get into that seat in the front of a 737. Is it an 800?
It is, yeah, yeah. The 800. Well, I was lucky enough, you know, to be introduced to aviation from my father from a young age. But really, it's just complete dedication. I mean, aerobatics especially is a competition sport. You just have to be focused on it yeah. all the time. You can I live it, breathe it, think it all the time. So it's just focus and planning and determination, really. There's
right.
this, it's kind of, someone once said to me, it's like climbing Everest, you know, and base camp is just a start, and then
yeah.
there's a long winding road and people stop along the way, and but to get to the top, I mean, it's just determination and dedication, yeah.
Right, okay. What's next apart from competing on the agenda for Michael? Because it's been pretty meteoric so far in your very young life.
yeah.
What are your aspirations moving forwards?
Well, really, I'd like to compete, obviously, and move up to the top level. Eventually, I'd like to be the youngest unlimited champion yeah. that the UK's ever had, and to hold that title as many times as I can. Apart from competition aerobatics, one of my main goals is to fly vintage warbirds.
Yeah.
So build up experience, and you know, I think flying Spitfires and things like that, you know, to really show, I like to show people, you know, what yeah. it's all about and inspire others, really, and young people. And I think that to fly warbirds would be great.
Right.
Keep the day job going and just enjoy it all, really.
Well, in the background we can hear aircraft. We're at Compton Abbas today. You're flying a pretty impressive aircraft today in another one of your roles, aren't you?
Yes, I am. So I'm flying today for a wing walking company called Aerobatic Tactics.
Yeah.
Doing wing walking for the general public and also charity events. So the aircraft we're flying is it's a Boeing, actually. It's the only biplane that Boeing made, but a little bit different to the 737. So it's built in 1940s, and, yeah, people stand on the wing and raise money, and
yeah.
it's good, yeah.
So what's she like to fly?
Nice, quite slow, and, you know, but nice and kind of... It's kind of like a sailing boat, you know? You take it out and you just cruise around, and it's comfortable. It's quite... It's quite a big and noisy, so it's typical American, but it's nice.
Now, it's a blustery day today. You've come down from Essex, long flight. How did that go?
Yeah, not too bad. We had a bit of a headwind all the way. I brought my girlfriend for our first flight in a Stearman, and it took us a bit longer than we thought, but it was good. Right, 1 hour 50, looking at the countryside.
Yeah, not bad. How did you route?
So we routed, we crossed the Thames initially, past the Dartford Bridge, and then just round Biggin Hill, north of Gatwick, and then past Guildford and just north of Southampton, and eventually onto Compton Abbas. So
how did Dad get here then?
How he drove. I'm not sure if that's a good job or the bad job. He was probably warmer than I was.
Yeah, probably. Michael, earlier in the programme, we spoke to Squadron Leader Davis. He's talked a lot about performance, about leadership, and about success. What words would you give to people maybe coming into the industry or thinking about coming into the industry to allow them the tools to get what they want from their careers?
Just really just focus, and you know, if you want to achieve something, then just go out and try and do it and be dedicated. And one thing I've learned, especially over the last few years, is don't be afraid to ask questions.
Yeah.
If you see someone and you learn from all of their experience, and they'll be able to guide you. So you can never have too much information, really, and just put everything you can into it, and opportunities come along that you wouldn't think would come along, and then eventually you'll be doing well.
Well, if we want to find out a little bit more about you, Michael, where can we find you on the web?
So I have a website up online now, and it's michaelpickin.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Mike Pickin.
Excellent. We will do. We're looking out for your results in June, and maybe we can catch up later in the season, see how you're doing.
Thanks very much. That'd be great.
Tim, I spoke to Mike's father after he went off and went back onto his flying duties, and he said to me that his son is simply an awesome pilot and expected to continue to excel. Now, a little secret here is Mike's father is a pretty mean aerobatic pilot himself, so not only is he very proud of his son, but sees something in him that is very special. So look out for him. If you can get to support Mike at Sidewell in the next week or so, please do go over and mention Extended to him. Now, we did talk to Mike after his flight about what he needs to move forward, and he's desperate to get some sponsors on board to help him on his international aerobatic challenges. So if you think there's any way you can help Mike, you'd be interested in supporting him or in any way, please go over to his website, his blog, or his Twitter feed, Mike Pickin, michaelpickin.com. He's on Instagram as well, and see if you can help him out. Remember, he's 24, probably one of the best pilots the UK has at that age. So let's see if we can get behind him.
Definitely. I mean, future, looking at future potential there. Good opportunity, yep. I would have thought, for some brand there to sponsor him and pick up the glory on the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Because without a shadow of a doubt, he will be successful in the advanced sector. And as he mentioned there in the interview, he will go on to perform internationally as well. He needs some support. So anyone out there who wants to get their name on a winning aircraft, I'm not saying it's guaranteed, but I've just seen the guy fly some wing walkers and it was pretty impressive. I'm sure when I was 24, I couldn't have dreamt of being in that place, as well as flying 737s for a living. Okay, let's move on again then, Tim. You had the opportunity when you're out in the States to speak to Dr. Rachel Ornan.
I certainly did, yeah. So this is a special part. This is it's almost a showroom for Boeing's interiors design for the cabin interiors. So they've got sort of 787 cabins in there. They've got a 777, 747 on two levels, and it's kind of like a showroom marketing tool, and also interestingly, a psychology sort of lab as well, if you like. I got to speak to Rochelle. gave us an absolutely fascinating sort of insight into how a Boeing sort of designs its cabin interiors.
My name is Rochelle Ornon. I am a regional director of a group called Cabin Experience and Revenue Analysis here at Boeing Commercial Airplanes.
And Rochelle, your job is putting the magic back into flight. Am I right?
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Yes, that and many other things. I wear a good number of hats. As a team, we deal with airlines. We help them optimize their configurations so they earn them the most money, but also so they have a preferred product for passengers. So we deal also directly with passengers, with crew, and with airlines, as well as internally talking about the benefits of new products and features for our cabin interiors.
And one of the amazing things here is you're doing a really deep dive into what the kind of passengers want, aren't you? You're really kind of sort of it's focus groups, it's talking to the passengers, listening to the passengers, but it's kind of real sort of deep psychological stuff, if you like.
Yes, it absolutely can be and is. We have this challenge of what are actually airlines looking for? What are their common burning questions? What do they want to see change in the industry? What do passengers actually want? So we have to understand the changing needs of air travelers, especially when we're developing a new airplane, say like the 777X. What are they looking for in terms of connectivity, in terms of architecture and lighting? What are some things that will be a surprise and delight the passenger of the future? At the same time, we've got the battle of the airlines, the battle of the space, the ancillary revenue opportunities. Where can we create more value to both the passenger as well as create additional revenue sources for the airlines? Because it's a tight market out there.
And the interesting part of your job as well is it's kind of bridge between the psychology, the dreams of flight, and the engineering. So give me some example of the kind of the human experience of flight and translating that into a product.
Into a design. Absolutely. So we discussed a bit earlier, but let's tell that story again. In the development of the 787 Dreamliner, we went directly to the flying public. What is it that a passenger in Brazil, a passenger in India, a passenger in the US, what are they looking for in terms of a flying experience? What's going to transcend the experience for all times? And so interestingly, and kind of not surprisingly, when you strip away all of the stress of actually getting through the airport and finding your way to your seat, the experience is absolutely magical. So what we wanted to do was understand, how do you translate this sense of needing to feel welcome on an international flight, feeling like you belong, but also being a part of the experience? And to do that, you can't directly ask passengers, right? The first thing you're going to find is, hey, I just want more legroom, which is actually under the domain of airlines predominantly. We can influence, but in the end, they're going to make their own decisions. But if we can take sort of these high-level dreams, hopes, and desires, which we can get from qualitative research, from surveys, from interviews, and then translate it into the built environment, that's one way we collect information and turn it into a product. Another way is, for example, something that was a little more technical in nature, is trying to understand the cabin environment. And by that, I mean, what's the importance of cabin altitude? What's the importance of cabin humidity on a passenger's experience? Particularly important on a long-haul flight. You know, if I'm going to be presenting in Europe and I'm on an overnight flight, I want to hit the ground running. I don't necessarily want to have to take an extra day in a hotel to feel like myself again. And that was a motivating factor in the design and development of the Dreamliner, with a lowered cabin altitude, 6,000 feet, and higher cabin humidity, anywhere from about 12 to 15% cabin humidity. It just makes people feel like themselves once they land. We have also been doing quite a bit of research understanding travelers' willingness to pay for certain bundles of features from a business class standpoint and from a premium economy class standpoint, so that an airline has is armed with more information of offering something that passengers want at a price point that they think will give them value. So that's another example of research.
Okay, and for the kind of the future of the passenger experience, what can passengers look forward to in the future doing? What technology or trends are we going to see in the future?
So the need to stay connected is huge. We absolutely need to make sure passengers can either connect if they want or disconnect if they want. And getting back to magic, simply being able to look out the window and enjoy your experience, having access to the beauty around you in the sky, is a huge selling point of why you should fly instead of taking a bus or a train for that matter. So the need to connect, the need to have a seamless travel experience is something that we're working very hard on. The need to stay connected with loved ones, and even, let's say, support the last-minute traveler, support all of the needs of whatever style of traveler you happen to be, make sure that we can accommodate you, with still hoping that you'll feel special in your own way. So basically, we enable the experience that you want to have.
Yeah.
So to be able to craft your specific customized experience is something that we're very much looking for in the future of passenger experience and traveler.
And when you travel yourself and you get can you detect gleams in people's eye when they sort of see a sky interior, or they kind of discover the 787's windows and things like that?
Yes, I have a really good story to tell you about that. So even though I give these briefings quite a bit in the cabin experience, as a cabin experience guide, and in the customer experience center, recently in the last year and a half, I was able to take my first Dreamliner flight on Norwegian Air Shuttle. I was flying premium economy at the time, and what was so exciting for me was seeing every single person in the premium economy cabin looking out the windows. Nobody, and I mean nobody, and I looked, trust me, because I was, you know, doing my usual observation. Nobody was listening to a book on tape. Nobody was looking down at a device. Nobody was even reading the magazine. Everyone was looking out. Why? Well, because we've had a revolutionary breakthrough in the interior with these passenger windows that are larger, bigger. They let in a tremendous amount of light in the cabin. And you can't help but look out because it invites you to. I can look left or right and I can see the horizon line. It's a very engaging experience. And as we attempted to do, and successfully, right there and there in the flesh, everyone was engaged in the flying experience upon takeoff. It was incredible for me to see.
Wow. And finally, your title has space exploration
it
in it.
It does.
So this is really, really interesting. You're going to be,
yes.
Part of your job is bringing the passenger experience to spacecraft.
Absolutely.
Tell us more.
I know. It's awesome what we get to do. So I've been working with Boeing Space Exploration in the design and development of the CST-100 interior. So granted, this is the start of a whole new generation, a whole new industry, and I feel so fortunate to be part of it. But this is no longer a government issue anymore. We are having, Boeing won the bulk of the contract for the NASA award to replace the space shuttle. We will have a full-time pilot operating that, and it's one of our very own. We will be having also paying flights eventually. Right now it's designed to service and bring resupply to the International Space Station, but what we're developing is a whole new era, a whole new reason to go to space. So it's not just the right stuff anymore. It's people like you and me. If you have the money initially, I imagine that's really going to be who the first takers are. But you want people to feel safe. You want them to feel calm and relaxed, just like we do on airplanes. And there's no better way to do it than providing a calming interior. So we've been successful at incorporating the Boeing Sky interior. Certain elements of it transitioned for use in space. Obviously, you can't have the same exact system. Weight is a much bigger factor when going to low Earth orbit. But the same, similar look and feel. So one day you could imagine an airline having a Dreamliner, a CST-100, a 737 Boeing Sky Interior, and no matter who you happen to be, you'll know you're on that airline's brand or that space line's brand because you recognize the interior. So it's been it's been a trip, let me just say that. It's been an amazing experience getting to work on that. And we're just now defining it. So there's a lot of lessons learned that we can take from the aviation industry into the design and development of the spacecraft interior industry as well.
Wow, that is absolutely fantastic. Well, thank you so much for talking to us.
You're so welcome.
And talking to Extended.
Tim, absolutely fascinating. And they're taking the psychology of the design of the cabin into the CS-100, into their space sector.
I
suppose it makes sense, but I was really genuinely surprised
How many people? How many people on the planet can say, you know, okay, I designed spacecraft, you know, maybe, but how many people are so to say, I designed the inside of spacecraft, you know, what a spacecraft will, you know, the cabin features and the you know the feel of a spacecraft. You know, we've all got our favorite spacecraft. You know, of the what it looks like inside. You know, Millennium Falcon and USS Enterprise and all that. And you know, to be there as somebody who you're talking to somebody who's actually kind of thinking about these things about, you know, well, you know, what would the astronauts of the future? What would the tourists of the future want to see in their spacecraft, and how do you also kind of link that into current airline designs and things like that? It's amazing,
fascinating stuff. I also thought it was really intriguing what she said about the 787, that she got on board and looked at what the other passengers were doing, and without fail they were all looking out those big windows. Which of course we would all do, but it's not often that you see everybody looking out of the windows. Have you flown on the 787 yet, Tim?
I haven't. No. This is on my list.
Yeah. My bucket list too. Fingers crossed. Maybe next year. Anyway, let's take a quick break then after that very long segment. And Tim, we're coming back to you for your latest X10.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
Oi, we know you're in there.
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
Foreign military aircraft, this is Chinese Navy. You are approaching our military alert zone. Leave immediately in order to avoid misjudgment.
I am a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace. I am operating with due regard as required under international law.
Foreign military aircraft, this is Chinese Navy. You are approaching our military alert zone. Leave immediately in order to avoid misjudgment.
I am a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace. I am operating with due regard as required under international law.
Okay, we're back, and we're back for this episode's X10 Top 10. For this episode, Top 10 Celebrity Pilots. Ever thought that pilot who just flew into your local flying club looked a bit familiar? Probably because there are a growing number of celebrity pilots. At number 10, Eddie Izzard. Cross-dressing, multilingual funny man, learned to fly to conquer a fear of flying. He's also been quoted as wanting to fire Spitfire between his comedy gigs around Europe. Tally-ho! At number 9, Michael Gambon. Everyone's favourite Hogwarts headmaster, British thespian Michael Gambon, is also a private pilot. Fun fact, while flying another actor over London, he pretended to have a heart attack at the controllers of his aircraft. At number 8, Brad Pitt. Another famous actor bitten by the flying bug, Brad Pitt was in the UK filming World War II epic Fury when he casually decided to buy a Supermarine Spitfire, as you do. At number 7, Lord Sugar. When it comes to flying, British business icon and entrepreneur Lord Sugar doesn't let anyone else be his apprentice. He prefers doing it himself. While his wealth means he can afford an Embraer Legacy 650 bizjet to shuttle him between deals, he also flies a Cirrus SR-22. At number 6, Angelina Jolie. Brad Pitt's other half is a keen aviator herself, flying a Cirrus SR-22, having got a license back in 2004. Brad, meanwhile, is reported to be buying a seaplane for her 40th birthday. Not bad. Meanwhile, her directorial debut, Unbroken, has a strong aviation link. It's being about a B-24 crewman who becomes a prisoner of war. At number 5, Tom Cruise. Having boosted US Navy pilot recruitment in the 1980s with Top Gun, it's perhaps no surprise that after playing a pilot, he would want to become one in real life too. Reportedly, he flies known as a P-51 Mustang. At number 4, John Travolta. There are movie stars who fly, movie stars who collect aircraft, and then there is John Travolta. An official Qantas brand ambassador, his collection of aircraft, which is rated to fly at one time, included a Boeing 707. His house, too, is more of an airport, allowing him to pick whichever his aircraft to go flying in. At number 3, Bruce Dickinson. Iron Man frontman Bruce Dickinson is also a rated commercial pilot and has flown the band on tour when not flying part-time with charter airlines. He's also now set up in aviation businesses such as Cardiff Aviation, is an investor in hybrid air vehicles, and presents TV programs of flying heavy metal, as well as flying a Fokker DR1 replica air shows. Phew! Fun fact, in 2014 Farmer Air Show, he flew an Eclipse 500 bizjet in the display. At number 2, Carol Vorderman. From Mass Whiffs to Air Training Corps Group Captain, via Rear of the Year, was on her profile, not mine, TV star Carol Vorderman, having learned to fly, has become an aerial ambassador of the joys of flight and inspiring girls into aviation. She's also reported to be planning a solo round-the-world flight. And at number 1, it has to be Harrison Ford. What could be more would be more reassuring than having your pilot say, "Never tell me the odds," when faced with a sticky situation? Harrison Ford, captain of the Millennium Falcon on screen, is also a pilot in real life, flying everything from vintage aircraft to helicopters, and recently escaped a nasty crash in a World War II era trainer. Fun fact, he apparently got a lifetime of membership with British Flying Club awarded to him so he could fly in between takes of the latest Star Wars film. And that's it. Any other ones we've missed out?
Tim, you got me on a few there. Eddie Izzard, I didn't know about that. Didn't know about Lord Sugar. Didn't know about Angelina and Brad. John Travolta, of course, he flies a 707. What a beautiful aircraft. And I did get to see Bruce Dickinson at Farnborough recently. We were hoping to potentially talk to Eclipse at some time, but we're still working on that. Also love to talk to Carol Vorderman about her flying career. What have you missed out? Do you know what I thought as you were reading that list, as we were getting close to number one? I just wondered whether Harrison Ford would be number two and you'd have one of the royals in at number one. Ooh. Prince Charles or Harry, of course, who flies the Apache, or Prince William, who of course is now a medevac pilot over in the east of England. So
could be. They'd have to maybe royals who fly, maybe that would be
another one,
because then that would be a whole new category. I did think of there was Gary Newman, who was obviously a Harvard owner, and as well as Nick Gilmore from Pink Floyd. They were both but I think, as far as I understand, Gary Newman had given up flying in the close formations in the sort of like the Harvard display team.
Right. Okay.
I haven't seen them on the circuit for a while.
Well, if you know anyone who's famous who Tim missed out on, then do drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook, on our Facebook pages, or of course you can always email us. Get involved at aviationextended.co.uk.
Military aircraft, attention. This is Chinese Navy. You are approaching our military zone. Please stay away this area and leave immediately. Your action is unfriendly and dangerous. Your actions are dangerous.
station calling U.S. military aircraft. Please identify yourself. I'm a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace. I am operating with due regard as required under international law.
Following military airplane. You are operating by military security aisle. Please go away quickly in order to avoid long judgment. 外国军机，离接近我军事警戒区，为避免误判，请立即远离。
Station calling U.S. military aircraft. Please identify yourself. I am a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace. I am operating with due regard as required under international law.
This is Chinese level. Please go away quickly in order to avoid long judgment.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so it is, we get to the get involved and feedback section of the show. As I mentioned earlier, it probably has been our busiest time, so I do apologise if we don't get everyone mentioned here. There simply have been too many to list. So we'll pick out a few. The first comes from Dave Homewood, of course, who produces the Wings Over New Zealand programme, which I'll come back to in a little moment. He did have a query regarding the RAF F4 Phantoms, and he says, I don't know much about the type, so I was interested to hear the recent interview about them, but the question that came to mind is, why did the Ministry of Defence purchase US-built Phantoms and then convert them to Rolls-Royce Spey engines? Now, he posted this on our Facebook page, and then short of reading a long number of replies from Mark Brewington, John Hodson, Merv Riches, David Lewis, and John Hodson, Dino Chapman, Paul Courtnage. If you want to find out the answer, you can find it in that number of responses. There are some personal bits of information and views as well. However, if you also want to learn a bit more about the reason for the use of the UK Rolls-Royce engines, you can go over to Omega Tau, the podcast. They've just released their F4 episode, and there's some fascinating information in there. But I think the summary was, Tim, that we bought the aircraft as a result of other failures, F-111, TSR-2, and that sort of thing. But we made the political decision to have the Rolls-Royce Speys put in there.
That's right. I mean, technically, they were more powerful than the GE engine, so it was kind of said, we'll make these better. But unfortunately, they had to kind of widen the fuselage.
Didn't quite work out that way, though, did it?
And they went slower.
Yeah. So we made the aircraft bigger and slower. Did sound good, though. So anyway, look up those responses. They're quite riveting. Okay, follower Mehdi Azaray. He says, hi, Peter, Tim and Gareth. It's not easy to outdo episode 39, but he thinks episode 40 may have done it for him. He loved the conversations, of course, with Tony Blackman and Dave Gledhill. He's got a question for you, though, Tim, on your X10 top 10. He said, could we squeeze the Concorde in as number 0.5 or 1.5? He says there's something to be said for consistently flying, paying passengers in luxury at Mark 2. So that was his suggestion there. He also responded to Amy's Pod's challenge about the air show course at Waddington and whether we'd get it back. He hasn't been to Waddington, but he's going to try and get there if it goes ahead in 2016. And of course, the question we wanted to know from Mehdi was all about his Iranian F-14 Tomcat sightings. And he says, Tim's right, he was there. Desful Air Show isn't terribly well known and it's not too easy to get to just yet, but it's incredible to see F4s, F5s, the F, they call it the F7, I think it's the Chinese MiG-21, Mirage F1s, Sukhoi 24s, MiG-29s, C-130s, F-27s, oh goodness me, on and on and on and on and on, and of course next to the F-14 side by side. He has sent us some links to some pictures. He has posted some on our Twitter feed. If you haven't seen those, go to those. I think short of the F4 Phantom pictures, they have seen literally tens of thousands of views. So Mehdi, thanks for that. They really proved popular. Steve Naz sent us a link regarding the live ISS footage, and he sent us a link to that. He says, guys, keep up the good work. Love the podcast. Not sure if you know, but NASA has an excellent feed from the ISS with high resolution cameras watching the Earth, and it's fascinating viewing. And that's, as I say, from Steve Naz, and he's from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. We'll put that link in the show notes. Thanks very much, Steve. Zach Yates, loved the episode with Dave Gledhill. We'll have to find and read all of Dave's books now. He also really enjoyed the Tony Blackman interviews as well. So thanks very much to that. He does mention, though, Tim, in your X10, how are the DH-88 and the X-15 not in your top 10? So, want to respond to that, or should we just say fair cop?
Well, I think the do we have the X-15 in the top 10 of space planes?
I'll have to look that up. I'm not sure. I think you might have. Fair shout on the DH-88. Do like that. Yeah, and I think I said an episode or two ago, thank you very much, whoever sent us that photo for my daughter. Good friend of the show, Neil Braden, is still a little bit behind. He's listening to Bio on the Tomcat episode, and he just said, just when I thought the guests couldn't get any better. So thank you very much, Neil, for that. Tim Davies, our squadron leader who we spoke to earlier, also wanted to get into the action, enjoys the podcasts, but he can't believe that in episode 32, back in September last year, the top 10 PC flight sims, we missed out MiG Alley. He says that's how I learned about lag pursuit roles and turn circle entry. Says the list was awesome, loved it, especially the Falcon 4 BMS. My students all use this. There you go, Tim.
Brilliant. Yeah, what I give for an updated, updated graphically, MiG Alley for 2015. That was a classic. Yeah.
Okay, I think we'll leave the feedback there. It's been a very full show so far, so let's move on. We didn't ask Amy to send us a challenge this month, as we know she's been really, really busy, so no pods challenge. But I do want to give a little shout out to Amy, and she doesn't know I was going to do this, so we'll do it anyway. She's got a business called Little Red UK, and she's got a VE photo shoot and party on June the 13th at 3 o'clock in South Hindley near Barnsley. So she has put a note out on her Facebook and Twitter feeds saying she's got a solo exhibition coming up in July and she needs to get some photo shoots done prior to this exhibition. We really need some VE Day recreation shots and want to get our local communities involved. So they've decided to hold a shoot at their local pub and then celebrate with a little party afterwards. So all they ask is that you come along dressed in 1940s attire. Ladies, please attend with 40s hair and makeup too. So sounds like if you help Amy out, there's a good shindig afterwards. So all the very best of luck, Amy, for that.
American military airplane. You are operating by military security air. Please go away quickly in order to avoid long judgment.
Station calling U.S. military aircraft. Please identify yourself.
This is the Chinese Navy. Please go away quickly in order to avoid long judgment.
I'm a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace. I'm operating with due regard as required under international law.
Go! American military airplane. American military airplane. You are operating by military security error. Please go away quickly in order to lose judgment.
Station calling U.S. military aircraft. Please identify yourself.
This is Chinese Navy. You are operating by military security error. Please go away quickly in order to lose judgment.
I'm a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace. I am operating with due regard as required under international law.
Aircraft transmitting, say again.
Right, on to promoting aerospace, Tim. Let's just go back to Dave Homewood, Wings Over New Zealand show. He does update us on his progress with the program, and I just want to give him a shout out for this latest episode when he talks to 97-year-old World War II veteran pilot, Flight Lieutenant Douglas Stanley Pesh Smith, DFC. I've listened to the episode. Absolutely intriguing. Lives over in New Zealand now, but flew for the RAF in the Second World War, flew Avro Yorks after the war, but he's flown everything from Wellingtons, Lancasters, DC-3s, and then on to some of the later stuff, the Viscounts, Friendships, and 737s. Fascinating interview. 97 years young, well worth a listen.
Excellent.
And yeah, it's great. And final shout out for a guest on our last show, Tony Blackman, and his publishers, Grub Street Books. They're going to be at the Wellesbourne Wings and Wheels on the 21st of June. So if you enjoyed hearing Tony on the last episode, get over there, and I think they're going to be doing some book signings. Now, Grub Street Books, I have an awesome portfolio, so get over there and have a look. So big shout out to them. Tim, any shout outs?
I mean, it's interesting, we were talking about top celebrity aviators, and we've also, yep, this past weekend we had the anniversary of Amy Johnson's flight, record-breaking flight to Australia, which ties the two things in together in the Amy Johnson lecture at the Royal Aeronautical Society in London on 9th of July is being given by a certain Carol Vorderman. So, if you're in London, if you're an AV geek, if you've got daughters, if you've got sons that are interested in aviation, that will be well worth a visit to hear Carol speak. You know, free entry, but I would RSVP early, as I think that one is going to be probably packed out.
Yeah, she's very, very popular. She's doing some fantastic work. Okay, thanks for that, Tim. Just a little reminder before we start wrapping things up. Joseph Chung, of course, has the extended livery for us. We mentioned in the last show, you can go over to our website and get links to that to download that for FSX. Sorry, that was a bit of a mouthful. So if you use that Flight Sim software, do download the extended livery. We've got the ringtones proving quite popular for some, so you can get those from our website. And Gareth has also put up some pretty good screensavers, laptop and PC screen saving shots as well, so you can download those free, and we're looking to build on that little library. So keep a watch out for that. Okay, just before we wrap up, want to tell you a little bit about what's in the pipeline. It's a really, really busy time for us in the coming couple of months. We hope to get to a couple of air shows and bring coverage of those for you. I hope to get to Yeovilton. Gareth will be at Riyadh, so we're hoping to talk to him in the press office there. Tim, you're going to be in Paris.
Certainly am, yep.
I don't know if we're going to manage to track you down in Paris, but we're going to certainly try and see if we can get a special out by getting you on the line there as well. And we're also looking to do a book special. Summer holidays coming up, sitting on the beach, maybe on the aeroplane trip, whatever it may be for you. We're looking to put together a summer reading special. So we hope to bring you that in the next couple of weeks as well. So busy time here at Extended. Okay, we would like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions, and to David Cenciotti over at The Aviationist for their permission in using the P8 inserts for this show. Hope you enjoyed those. But of course, we want to thank you, the listeners, both new, regular and old timers who have sticked with us, particularly, as I said, in the last couple of months where we've literally been inundated with social media traffic supporting the programme. Thank you very, very much. You can find Extended on Stitcher.com and of course on iTunes, or download it directly from the website. Of course, our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program is produced with a Creative Commons license. Okay, Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, I'm at RES Timar on Twitter. And if you want to find out more about the Royal Aeronautical Society, it's www.aerosociety.com.
You can find me at NASCOT Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. So that's it. Another very full episode. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim.
Goodbye, everybody. You'll see you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Okay, I'm here in Seattle at Boeing's Customer Experience Center in a fantastic place with Rochelle Oman, PhD.
Or non. I know.
From the top, okay, I'm here at Boeing's Customer Experience Center in Seattle with Rochelle Oman.
Or not.
It's been a long week.
I could introduce myself.
Okay, take three. I'm here in Boeing's Customer Experience Center with Rochelle Oman.
Yes, my name is Rochelle Ornan, and I work at the customer experience in... I'm going to say it again.
Right, I'll just try this one more time. We'll get your name right, I promise. Okay, so I'm here at the for Aviation Extended at the Boeing's Customer Experience Center with Rochelle Ornan, PhD, who is Regional Director, Cabin Interiors and Passenger Experience. And also Space Exploration Liaison.
Wonderful.
And that's a wrap.
That was quite slick.
Yeah, yeah. What happened?
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.